Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Israel held its second election in 6 months last night, and the results are deadlocked. But Israel isn't the only country in the Middle East facing uncertainty right now. Tensions in the region have continued to rise. Days after drone attacks on Saudi oil fields and a processing plant there, the United States blames Tehran for those attacks. And today, President Trump tweeted that he's ordered increased sanctions on Iran. This all comes after collapse of U.S. peace talks with the Taliban in Afghanistan. So this hour on Point, we want to get a holistic view of this moment in the Middle East, and we'll talk with a veteran U.S. diplomat who served across the region. And you can join us. What do you make of the deadlocked election results in Israel? What do you think it means for the future of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu there? What's your question about the escalating tensions with Iran? Join us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And in a few minutes, as I mentioned, we will be talking with Ambassador Ryan Crocker about how he sees tensions in the Middle East playing out. But first, let's talk in detail about the Israeli elections. And joining us from Tel Aviv, Israel, is Kobi Ben-Melech. He is Bloomberg's bureau chief for Israel and the Palestinian territories. Kobi, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
Hi. So tell us, we have this seeming deadlocked result between Likud and the Blue and White Party. What is likely to happen in the next couple of days?
Well, it's anybody's guess at this point. The results are inconclusive, but what can be said is that it does not look very good for Netanyahu. As you said, this is the second election in the last 5 months here, and this came about because he couldn't form a government in April and May. And it, at the moment, at present, if the numbers hold, he doesn't have enough support to do that again. And the timing is quite bad for Netanyahu because he's facing corruption charges. He's been accused of fraud, breach of trust, and the most severe case, of course, is bribery. And he's got a hearing in early October, so the timing is really bad for Netanyahu.
So tell us a little bit more about that, because, Kobi, right now it seems as if the next step is this jockeying for between Likud and the Blue and White Party about seeing if they can form some kind of coalition. Are they likely at all to come into coalition with each other?
That's a fascinating question, and the main obstacle to that is Benjamin Netanyahu himself. Benny Gantz has said several times that he is not willing to sit in the government with a prime minister who's facing indictment. And Benjamin Netanyahu, of course, wants to continue on as prime minister. It's been reported in the past that one of the conditions he has for joining his government is trying to pass a law that would immunize him from these corruption indictments, which is something that Benny Gantz won't stand for. What gets really interesting, of course, is where do we go from there? I mean, as you said, we're in a deadlock. And will members of Benjamin Netanyahu finally kick out their vaunted leader and for the sake of a national unity government? I mean, we've only just begun the process. The election was phase one.
Right. Well, so, Kobi, I wonder if we could take a step back here and just help us understand more about sort of the big picture in Israeli politics right now. Because, first of all, this Blue and White Party and Benny Gantz, who is he and what does, what aspect of Israeli politics does the Blue and White Party represent?
So they are a centrist party. I mean, they're a mashup in a sense of security types. I mean, Benny Gantz himself was a former military general. The two others in his party were also former military generals. So these are people with serious security credentials, which is paramount when it comes to Israeli politics. most of the country votes on that. So their policies, their stances don't differ too much from Netanyahu and his Likud party in terms of security. But what they do, their rallying cry is to say, that, you know, enough of Netanyahu. We cannot have a prime minister facing these serious charges, lead the country. The country faces too many challenges, and we need someone who is free of this constraint.
So has the ground, in terms of Israeli politics, has the ground been shifting under Netanyahu's feet for some time now? It seems like there's been pushback against, his right-wing approach to Israeli politics.
I would say, in a sense, the country has shifted more towards Netanyahu's stances over the last 10 years. The country, Israelis writ large, are, let's say, skeptical towards the peace process with Palestinians. That dates back to the Second Intifada in the early 2000s. So the trauma of that coloring Israelis' attitude towards a peace process with Palestinians, and you can see it again with Benny Gantz, who's again considered a centrist, adopts more or less the same stances when it comes to security control over key areas in the West Bank, and annexing Jewish settlements in the West Bank in any future agreement with the Palestinians. The only slight difference between Gantz and Netanyahu is that Gantz is a bit more open to entering peace negotiations with the current Palestinian leadership, whereas Netanyahu, there haven't been any peace talks in, I think, the last 4 or 5 years. So in that sense, there might be more of an opening with Gantz when Trump, for example, is supposed to lay out his Middle East peace plan in the coming days.
I see. Okay, well, let's listen to a little bit of what Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said just this morning in Tel Aviv. Here's what he said in a video that's being interpreted by France 24.
In these coming days, we are going to start the political bargaining process to create a strong Zionist government and to prevent the creation of an anti-Zionist dangerous government. That is what we need to do.
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu speaking in Tel Aviv today. Now, here is Benny Gantz, who we mentioned is the head of the Blue and White Party. He told supporters in Tel Aviv he's already begun talking to allies, he says. And again, here he is speaking through interpretation from France 24.
I will talk to everyone. Starting this evening, we will work to create a government of national unity that is broad and that represents every citizen.
That's Benny Gantz speaking today in Tel Aviv. Kobi, tell us, in the middle of all this is Avigdor Lieberman. He's being called in the U.S. press a kingmaker, a potential kingmaker now. Who is he and what role does he have to play?
Most certainly a kingmaker. The way the numbers worked out in this election as it stands, he was the deciding factor why Israel is went to elections again after after Netanyahu failed to form a government in May. He took a stand against Netanyahu. Netanyahu and he were allies on and off, of course. But they trade in the same right wing politics. I mean, they're both nationalists, and they both are both skeptical of the peace process with Palestinians. And he actually almost doubled his parliamentary seats. So he holds real power here in terms of the makeup of the next governing coalition. And he's been pushing for what's called a national unity government between the Likud. You should notice, though, that when he does mention this, he does not say led by Benjamin Netanyahu. Mm. And Benny Gantz and his party, what's called Israel Beiteinu, Israel is our home. So he has been one of the main, one of the main people dictating the pace of the horse trading so far. In the lead-up to election, election and most certainly afterwards.
Wow. Now, in the last couple of minutes that we have, Kobe, I want to ask you, because I do need to ask you about the strong showing that the joint list had in the election. That's a conglomeration of four Arab parties led by Ayman Odeh, who I think they won 12 seats yesterday, and that puts them in possibly in the position of leading the formal opposition in the Israeli parliament.
Yes, assuming, and there's a low chance that this will happen, assuming that they don't enter into a coalition, which has never happened before in Israeli history. But yeah, I mean, that would be unprecedented. I mean, this is someone who represents the Arab minority, and when I say minority, it's 20% of the population in Israel, having a very dignified position, someone who gets security briefings. Again, this is a country that has security dealings in almost all its frontiers. So this is someone that will be, taken far more seriously, which would be a monumental step up for Arab participation in Israeli politics.
Mm. Now, Odeh has said that, quote, our direction is very clear. We want to change Netanyahu's government, but we are not in anyone's pocket. So what does he mean by that?
Traditionally and historically, the Arabs in Israel have boycott is too strong a word, but they've been very distant in terms of participating in Israel's government because their stances are so far from the mainstream Israeli politics. So when he says we're not going to be in anybody's pocket, what he's alluding to there is they're not going to give up some of their core principles in order to join a mainstream sort of centrist Israeli government.
But they find themselves in an interesting position now due to their stronger than usual showing last night in the election. Kobe, we've got 30 seconds left here. I want to swing back to Benjamin Netanyahu himself.
Yep.
I mean, either way, it seems like what you're saying is that in the next couple of weeks or months, he finds himself in a precarious position as leader of Likud.
Most certainly. As I said before, he's got the indictment hearing coming up in a few weeks, and he's got no clear path to forming government. So really, he's never been weaker before at this stage in the electoral process. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens in the coming weeks.
Well, Kobi Ben-Melech is Bloomberg's bureau chief for Israel and the Palestinian territories, speaking to us from Tel Aviv, Israel today. Kobi, thank you so very much.
Thanks, Magna.
Well, when we come back, we'll talk with Ambassador Ryan Crocker. He has served as U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Syria, Kuwait, and Lebanon. We'll get his whole view of this moment in the Middle East now. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll be spending the rest of the hour now talking to Ambassador Ryan Crocker. He has served as U.S. ambassador 6 times to Afghanistan, to Iraq, Pakistan, Syria, Kuwait, and Lebanon. He's served in both Republican and Democratic administrations. He's diplomat in residence at Princeton University, and he joins us today from Spokane, Washington. Ambassador Crocker, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. And I want to let listeners know that we'll be talking with the ambassador about the Israeli elections, about Iran, about Saudi Arabia, about Afghanistan. We really want to get a whole region view here from one of the U.S.'s most prominent diplomats to the region for several years. And we want to know what your question is for Ambassador Crocker. So Ambassador Crocker, let's just first start off with those Israeli elections. You heard me talk with Kobi Ben-Melech before the break here. What's your first your first analysis on the deadlock yet again in the second Israeli election in 6 months?
I think that is a feature of the Israeli political system. We've seen it before, the way their democracy is structured and the way politics in the country have run now for some time. Neither of the two major parties is able any longer to maintain or to achieve an absolute majority, which means that all governments are coalition governments, and that gives inordinate power to the smaller parties, as we've just seen with Avigdor Lieberman and his Israel Bettina. Mm. So this is going to be another one of those struggles that we witnessed in the spring, and I'm not sure we're going to see any definitive outcome. The chances now of a national unity government which will be anything but unified, I think are probably greater than the first time around.
But in terms of Washington's, or I should say the United States' relationship with Israel, would a national unity government in Israel be the one that the U.S. most desires?
Well, clearly it's up to the Israelis what kind of government
Absolutely.
They get. I think the key point that we heard in your earlier conversation, there isn't much daylight between the blue and white party and Likud on the crucial issue of security, whether it has to do with the Palestinian territories or whether it has to do with Israel's position in a very turbulent region. So whichever way this goes, or if it goes to a national unity government, I think on the critical issues for us with Israel and for them with us, security, I don't think that much is going to change.
Mm-hmm. So let's then widen our lens here a little bit, because I want to talk in detail with you, Ambassador, about the significance of those drone attacks on the Saudi oil fields. I'm seeing a lot of different analysis from different corners of the foreign policy world saying that how the U.S. chooses to respond, how President Trump chooses to respond to those attacks is really going to help define sort of the U.S. posture in the region for quite some time. What do you think about that?
I think it's important to take a step back, take a deep breath, take a look around the region, and then see what it all means. It's not a time for a rush to judgment. I am mildly encouraged so far that the voices in Washington, including the president's, after a volatile start, are basically saying, let's see what happened here. Let's talk to the Saudis. Let's talk to others, and then let's figure it out. That is a pretty good posture. This did not come out of the blue, as you know so well. I mean, one way to look at the Middle East right now, to try to find some context to make sense of it all, would be to think of a Middle East Cold War between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And you see that play out, of course, in Yemen, but also in Lebanon, in Syria, and in Iraq. It doesn't explain everything, but it does explain a lot. Now what we've seen, of course, is that Cold War has just become a little hotter. But again, it's important to have, I think, that context. This struggle has been going on for years between the two countries, at least since 2005, when the Iranians were blamed for the assassination of Lebanese Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri in Beirut, a very close ally of the Saudis. So the struggle is not new. The means by which it is being pursued, that has changed.
So why is that changing now? I mean, is Iran feeling that perhaps there's Perhaps there's fewer consequences to adopting a more bellicose posture than there was before. I mean, I don't know why they would think that, because just today, right, President Trump has announced that he's directing the Treasury Department to increase sanctions on Iran. But why is this happening now?
Meghna, let me first just offer a small caveat here. One thing we Americans don't do terrifically well is modesty and humility. Iran is, by any measure, the most complex political society in a very complicated region. We have not been on the ground in Iran since 1979. So our capacity to really understand what they're about and why is severely limited, and that includes me. All of that said, I think what you're seeing here is an Iranian reaction to the U.S. Pullout from the nuclear agreement and our imposition of sanctions. Their economy is hurting. They know it, and we know it. And I think this is a way for them to say, do not underestimate us. Do not think you can run us into the ground. Do not think that we are going to capitulate, however much pressure you apply. And, of course, I think the reaction we've seen is absolutely what they should have expected, that the president will double down on this. He will probably interpret this strike as an indication that his policy is working. Maybe it is. I'm not so sure.
So let's listen for a moment to what the Iranian Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei, said yesterday on Iranian state television regarding his assertion that there will be no new talks with the United States.
Officials of the country unanimously say that we won't negotiate with America. There will be neither unilateral nor trilateral talks. We must prove that the maximum pressure policy is not worth a penny against the Iranian nation.
That's the Iranian Supreme Leader just yesterday on Iranian state television. And in Washington at the Heritage Foundation, Vice President Mike Pence yesterday said that the U.S. is prepared to defend its allies in the Middle East.
As the president said, we don't want war with anybody. But the United States is prepared. We're locked and loaded. And we're ready to defend our interests and our allies in the region. Make no mistake about it.
Vice President Pence, just yesterday. Ambassador Crocker, so there's the sort of the political bluster, the language of the moment for public consumption here. But is there an opportunity, sort of a back channel or a diplomatic opportunity also opening at the same time that Washington might be wise to pursue?
There's always an opportunity for diplomacy. I made my living doing that for almost four decades, so I'm a big fan. And I think it's pretty clear as we look again at a very complex crisis that for the U.S. military, for all Americans really, if there is a political, a diplomatic way out of a confrontation, that's always preferable than going into yet another war. And I would underscore here, it is volatile. Anything can happen. It's the Middle East. But I do not see this as, a sure march into conflict for the United States, not by any means. Mm. So is there an opportunity? Of course there is. I think it's going to be difficult for this administration to make any kind of discreet overture to the Iranians, as the previous administration did. The secret talks that the Omanis brokered that led up to the successful nuclear negotiations. I'm not sure that this administration is inclined that way, and frankly, I'm not sure they're capable of doing it. But the chance is there. I would expect that, for example, in Paris today, that the French president is thinking about what can France do now. Mm. He's shown an interest in the past and seen if he could be a catalyst for a conversation between our leadership and the Iranian leadership. In the region, there are going to be other states that are sitting right on top of this that do not want to see it get any hotter. So again, it's a time to be doing a lot of talking, a lot of listening, and keeping the rhetoric in check.
So let me ask you for a moment here. Let's shift the the frame here to Saudi Arabia itself. First of all, I mean, were you surprised at all that drones were able to penetrate Saudi airspace and successfully attack possibly their most important and sensitive facilities in the country? Was that a surprise to you?
It is a surprise to me on one level. I haven't seen any conversation thus far to indicate that the incoming attack was seen by anyone, not picked up by Saudi air defense systems or air monitoring systems. Perhaps more telling, and perhaps of even greater concern here, assuming those missiles did come from Iran, they crossed the Persian Gulf. We have a Fifth Fleet headquarters in Bahrain. We have warships up and down the Gulf. Did we not detect it? So I am very interested in what the forensic teams that are out there now discover about the means of the attack. Was it drone-fired weapons? Was it cruise missiles? And above all, why didn't we know it was happening if, in fact, we did not?
Those are some pretty big questions, Ambassador. Actually, you know, it hadn't occurred to me that we haven't received any confirmation about whether the United States had detected it. And if the okay, so this is speculation, but if the answer is no, what does that mean? What are the implications of that?
Well, for me as a civilian, it would suggest that we had better have a pretty big, pretty deep, and pretty quick investigation on this apparent vulnerability. If missiles can be shot or some form of weapon can be fired literally over our heads and we don't even know it, what does that tell us about our vulnerability? And more importantly, what does it tell our adversaries, actual or potential, about our vulnerability?
Hmm. So let me play something that the president himself said about Saudi Arabia earlier this week. So here's President Trump speaking to reporters on Monday.
That was an attack on Saudi Arabia, and that wasn't an attack on us. But we would certainly help them. They've been a great ally. They spend $400 billion in our country over the last number of years.
It's President Trump on Monday. And just a little fact check here. In the past decade, the U.S. and Saudi Arabia have had $85.5 billion in sales agreements, but only $25 billion roughly of that in actual deliveries so far. Ambassador Crocker, so if you're Saudi Arabia, actually, I was going to say, if you're Saudi Arabia right now, what do you think about this moment? But let me rephrase the question here. Do you think the Trump administration's approach to Saudi Arabia right now is the right one?
From what I know of it at this point, Meghna, I think it is. The president is correct. This was an attack on Saudi Arabia, not on us. We don't have a defense treaty with Saudi Arabia that would obligate us to come to their physical defense in an incident such as this. So that's correct, and I think it's, you know, the right posture to take. Secretary Pompeo is out there now talking to the leadership. That's exactly what we need to do to get their assessments and the benefit of their thinking. Saudi Arabia is, of course, a difficult case for us. It has been for years, not just over the Khashoggi killing in Istanbul. Mm. But we also have to remember, in the Middle East, we don't really have the luxury of the choice between democracies and autocracies. There's only one fully fledged democracy out there, Israel. So what we've got, I would say, is the choice between the forces of order and the forces of disorder. Saudi Arabia is part of the forces of order. Iran, again, as we've just seen again, that is a force of disorder. So for all of the dissatisfaction of how the Saudis govern themselves and treat their people, I get it. I share it. we need to think very carefully about trashing an alliance that has anchored our presence in the region literally since the end of World War II.
Ambassador Crocker, if I may, though, I mean, the Saudis' bombing of Yemen, the fact that a bulk of the 9/11 terrorists were Saudis, one could even say the kingdom's support for Wahhabism, extreme Wahhabism around the world, many view that those actions as forces of massive disorder.
And what are the alternatives? I've become fond of saying that in the Middle East, just as you don't have a choice between democracy and autocracy, you don't have a choice between good and bad options. You've got bad options and you've got worse options. So to take a stand on principle, you really need to be very, very careful. And I'd take you back. In addition to modesty, history is something else Americans aren't terribly good at, but it is important. At the end of World War II, Franklin Roosevelt, in failing health, made a trip out to the Middle East, February 1945, where he met on the deck of a U.S. destroyer the then King of Saudi Arabia, Ibn Saud. A photograph that rattled around the world. And he did it for a reason, that in that post-war order that he envisioned 2 months before he died, Saudi Arabia would be a critical kingpin. And the deal was oil for security.
Right.
Things have changed, obviously. We don't depend on Saudi oil anymore, but boy, our allies do, South Korea and Japan. So again, with all the problems we've had in the relationship, it is important to think twice and three times before we say we're done with it.
This is a really important point, and I'm going to pick it up with you, Ambassador, when we come back. We're talking with Ambassador Ryan Crocker. He has served as U.S. Ambassador to Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Syria, Kuwait, and Lebanon. And we're getting a sort of a whole view, a diplomat's whole view of this moment in the Middle East. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Ambassador Ryan Crocker. He has served as U.S. ambassador across the Middle East, from Afghanistan to Iraq, Syria, Kuwait, Lebanon, and Pakistan, in both Republican and Democratic administrations. And we're getting his sort of his diplomat's whole view of this moment in the Middle East. So what is your question for a veteran U.S. diplomat? And Ambassador Crocker, I definitely want to talk with you about Afghanistan in a couple of minutes here, but we have some callers who have some questions about Saudi Arabia, so let me go to them. Carlos is calling from Tampa, Florida. Carlos, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Yes, I wanted to comment on what the ambassador said regarding what the United States have to overlook, the behavior of Saudi Arabia. However, the United States is such a powerful, is the most powerful country in the world. And the Saudis will listen to us. They have to. Even their weapon systems that are U.S. Made will not be able, you know, the Saudis will not be able to change their weapon systems and say, okay, we'll go to the Russians or the Chinese. They depend on us to a large extent. So why not use the leverage the United States has to change Saudi behavior? They will be scared to death to contradict the United States, especially now that Iran is on their heels.
Right. Carlos, thank you for your call. Ambassador Crocker, do you have a response for him?
It's a great question. I'm sure we're having those conversations with the Saudis. For them to be effective, they need to be just that, a quiet conversation. You do not get change in any country in its internal processes by yelling at them publicly. So if we want to see change in Saudi Arabia, and we most definitely do, the best way to do that is establish a strong strategic relationship, reestablish one, and then use that as a basis for that conversation. It's how the world works. We are the most powerful nation on earth. That doesn't mean we can deliver orders to vassal states. Other states have leverage. We are looking at Iran. We can not exactly order Iran to do what we want or stop doing what we don't want. So diplomacy is important. Diplomacy is complex, and it doesn't work by just laying out a set of conditions. You meet them or you're done.
Hmm. Let's go to Sandy, who's calling from Hudson, Maine. Sandy, you're on the air.
Hi. I also wanted to talk about the Saudi oil field bombings. And the Houthi rebels, as I understand it, have already claimed responsibility for the attack. And it seems to me like exactly the kind of tactic that a smaller force would use kind of as an equalizer. So I'm puzzled about why the Americans and the Saudis are saying, no, 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 the Houthis didn't do it. It was Iran. It's almost like we're looking for excuses to pin this on Iran, even after the Houthis have claimed responsibility. Mm. And I'd really like to hear Ambassador Crocker's take on that.
You know, it reminds me of the bad old days. I was in Lebanon in the early 80s, where you had about a bomb a day, routinely claimed by 17 different organizations, half of whom probably didn't exist. So a claim of responsibility establishes nothing. That's why the forensic examinations going on now are so important. For the Houthis to have done this, well, that was been a trip of like 500-odd miles. And to do that with precision targeting at the other end would be an extraordinary accomplishment, and really it would probably take you right back to the same place. Could the Houthis have done that on their own? Almost certainly not. It would have been with Iranian help. So whichever way you go with this so far, I think you come back to Iran. Mm.
Well, Ambassador Crocker, before we get to Afghanistan, I want to ask you sort of one more big picture question about the Middle East. Because just yesterday in Foreign Policy magazine, Stephen Cook published a very fascinating article. The headline of it is, This is the moment that decides the future of the Middle East. And in his first paragraph, I just want to read it and get your take on it. Because Cook says, since the end of World War II, which, by the way, Ambassador, you mentioned a couple of times before the break, since the end of World War II, three core interests have shaped U.S. Middle East policy: ensuring the free flow of energy resources from the region, helping to maintain Israeli security, and making sure no state or group of states can challenge American power in a way that puts the other two interests at risk. In other words, aside from the strategic, historical, and moral and political reasons for the special U.S.-Israel relationship, oil is the reason why the United States is in the Middle East at all. And then Cook goes on to say, you know, as you said, we don't depend on Saudi oil the way we did after World War II. Even though our allies may, I mean, are we seeing a shift in the fundamental tripartite reasons for American continuous involvement in the Middle East for the past 70 years?
I certainly hope not. Let's just take a look at the different aspects of that piece. Let's start with Israel and Israel's security. If we're thinking of trashing our relationship with Saudi Arabia, maybe we should talk to the Israelis about that. If you noticed, when President Trump made his first visit to the Middle East, his first stop was Saudi Arabia. His second stop was Israel. When Air Force One left Riyadh, it filed a flight plan directly for Lod Airport in Tel Aviv. That is the first time that has ever happened. The Saudis have always insisted we file to a third destination and then refile once we're out of Saudi airspace. A small gesture, but diplomacy is made of small gestures and important symbols. That was one. The Saudi and Israeli tacit security cooperation is pretty important to Israel. Or take another autocrat that we are not enamored of right now, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. President of Egypt. Mm-hmm. I was in a meeting with him a few years ago. He bounded into the room to say, I want to thank you. For what? I asked. He said, for the Camp David agreements. They're the cornerstone of Egypt's security, and we couldn't have done it without you. And then he said, but I have one real regret, and that is that I have a better relationship with the Prime Minister of Israel than I do with the President of the United States. So if we're talking about Israel's security, they live in a very dangerous region, forces of order, forces of disorder. Take oil. I mentioned this earlier. We don't depend on it, but our Asian allies absolutely do. So this comes to a fundamental question of U.S. leadership in the world. Fortress America, we can retreat, we can withdraw, we can say we've got ours, we don't need oil, you do, good luck. Well, that is not the way the world has worked since World War II. And if we want to think about no longer leading in the world, we should consider the consequences. If we don't lead, who will? I'm not afraid the Chinese are going to usurp us. I'm afraid that no one will have any ability to lead. And then we're going to see the forces of entropy and chaos start to emerge everywhere.
Well, let's get one more call here. Nimrod is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. You're on the air.
Hi, Magda. First of all, I just wanted to say you have a wonderful show.
Thank you very much. What's your question for the ambassador?
So I want to disagree about the forces of order versus forces of disorder, since, you know, it all depends on your point of view, when both sides can be forces of order and forces of disorder. And I think in terms of the Trump administration, it looks like some of this disorder was created because of the policy. And what, you know, no one knows the future, but the way I see it is nothing's going to happen until the elections, because Iran is learning from North Korea and other countries of, you know, holding their hand out, but then keeping the coals hot and making the situation a little bit hot by attacking, for instance, the Saudi oil rigs. And so they're just going to keep on doing this dance until they see if he gets reelected or not. And then they'll have to make the decision. What do we do next? So right. It's just going to keep on building until the elections.
Well, Nimrod, thank you so much for your call. Ambassador Crocker, I'll give you a chance to respond to him really quickly. And then I definitely want to talk to you about Afghanistan.
The world doesn't wait for anything, including our elections. The world moves on, and the Middle East can move faster than the rest of the world. So I think everyone is calculating in the here and now. The Iranians are, I think, not looking at the coming election. They're looking at their current situation and particularly their economy as they feel backed into a corner. Obviously, what happens in our elections are important to the world. It is something people think about all the time, but I don't think that what we're looking at now is in any way geared toward an election that's over a year away.
Okay, so Ambassador Crocker, you served in Afghanistan in 2011-2012. First of all, it seems very much as if peace talks just very quickly collapsed in the past couple of weeks here. What's your view on this moment in Afghanistan? Can those talks be reinvigorated?
Frankly, I hope very much that they have collapsed and they will not be reinvigorated, at least in the manner that we saw them unfold for much of the past year. For the United States to sit down with the Taliban leadership without the government of Afghanistan in the room was a major strategic error. Because what we are doing basically is saying the Afghan government is not legitimate. We caved in to the Taliban demand that they would talk to us directly, but they would not tolerate representatives of what they call a stooge regime to be present. We gave in to that. And that immediately put in my mind the Paris peace talks in the 70s that, quote, ended, close quotes, the Vietnam War. Those weren't peace talks. Those were surrender discussions. And that's the same thing we were telling the Taliban. We're done here. We want to get the best terms we can. We want to put lipstick everywhere and hope that nobody notes what's underneath. So I'm relieved, quite frankly, that this phase is over. Eventually, there are going to have to be talks. You don't end wars any other way. But you do not go into negotiations at that level from a position of weakness. That's diplomacy 101, and that is just what we did.
Ambassador Crocker, so given what you just said, if and when peace talks are renewed, I mean, with the Taliban has already seen that it has a strong negotiating position here. Will it acquiesce to the Afghan government being at the table?
Meghna, we're going to have to see. I can't predict that. What I can predict is the trajectory we were on would have led us nowhere good. If the Taliban retake the country, you've basically gone back to the status quo ante pre-9/11. We've seen that movie. The Taliban, harboring al-Qaeda, created the 9/11 attacks. They have not broken that link with al-Qaeda. As a matter of fact, they have accepted 18 years in the wilderness for their leadership rather than give up al-Qaeda. We gave them that choice. They chose to lose the country. To give it back to them with that relationship intact would be the height of folly. And I would add one other thing. We were talking about values and principles with respect to our relationship with Saudi Arabia. That applies in Afghanistan. I was there as ambassador 2011, 2012. I also reopened the embassy after the fall of the Taliban at the beginning of 2002. The first thing we did in terms of assistance to Afghanistan was to start opening girls' schools. Girls had been excluded from education since the rise of the Taliban and the takeover of Kabul in the mid-90s. We were determined to do everything we could to bring girls and women back into society. We encouraged them to go to school, to go to college, to join the military, to run for parliament, where over a quarter of representatives are female. And they did. Implicit in that was an American statement: you step forward, we have your back. If we pull out and the Taliban comes in, what do we think is going to happen to those girls and women? What are we going to say to them? You've made great strides, but look at the time. We've got to be going. Goodbye and good luck. That would be, I think, a fundamental betrayal of American values as well as of American national security interests.
With all due respect, Ambassador, hasn't that betrayal in a sense already happened, given the strength of the Taliban today?
Well, that's a great question. What is the strength of the Taliban today? How many provincial capitals does the Taliban hold in Afghanistan? There are 30-odd provinces. Well, I'll give you a hint. It's a nice round number. It's zero. They have in the past been able to take a capital city in a province and hold it for maybe a day or two, and then they have to give it up. So as we argue over what percentage of territory the Taliban control, you got to ask better questions than that. I mean, a lot of the territory of Afghanistan is uninhabited and uninhabitable. It doesn't matter. What does matter is who controls population centers. It isn't the Taliban. Does that mean they're losing? Not really, but it certainly means they're not winning. And that is the kind of situation from which effective diplomacy can arise. Do they want to do this forever? Probably not. What could a compromise deal look like? I don't know. We may be in a position to find out after the Afghan elections. But I do know it didn't look like what we had on the table before the president broke off these talks.
Well, Ambassador Ryan Crocker, he has served as U.S. ambassador in Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Syria, Kuwait, and Lebanon. He's diplomat in residence at Princeton University, speaking to us today from Spokane, Washington. Ambassador, this has been an absolutely fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.